Parent who's come down from the early risers group at Gwinnett Room. Please welcome Karen.
Thank you very much. It's always a privilege and an honor to be asked to participate in anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's been a while since I've done this, so I'm a little nervous, but it's okay. My name is Karen. I am an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is January 23rd, 2005. My home group is the Early Risers at the Gwinnett Room. It's a 7 a.m. Monday through Friday meeting, which is an 11-step meeting, which is absolutely incredible. I just love it. It was a turning point in my sobriety, the 11th step. This will just start from the beginning, just the basics. I was born and raised in the Chicago area. I've been in Georgia now for greater than 30 years, so this is home. But I was born and raised up in the north and came from a very normal, non-alcoholic family. I was the oldest. I have two younger sisters. And growing up was basically uneventful. I mean, we were an average suburban family with no real issues. I mean, I can remember early on just feeling just a little bit that I didn't fit in, but, you know, it really wasn't a big concern. I was always a good kid, did what I was supposed to, did what I was told, that kind of thing. The first time I ever had a drink, I was 16, and I drank way, way too much. And I hated it. Absolutely hated it. And I thought, I will never do this again. But obviously that did not happen, or I wouldn't be standing here. And then I went on to school. I went to nursing school up north. And, you know, my drinking was on and off through then. But at the beginning of school, we had a horrible tragedy happen in our family. My dad died very suddenly. I was 19. Completely rocked our world. We were just, it was sudden. Had no idea it was coming. I mean, it was a sudden death. And, you know, I was the oldest. I was only 19. I had two younger sisters. My mom was devastated. It was tough. And I just chose to, you know, pick up and move on. And I did. Went through school. And 2.5 years later to the day, my mom died. Unexpected, sudden. So I was, I think, 21 at that time. I had just gotten married. And I had been married for about a year, I think. Well, that kind of set things off for me. I was drinking a lot more regular with a few other substances involved along the way. I decided that I needed to change everything, which meant I got a divorce. I left Illinois. I moved here with another man. I got pregnant, had a miscarriage, then got a divorce, then got married, then had my first child, all in an 18-month period. So chaos and unmanageability came to me at a young age. But I just did what I thought I had to do. And I have two children. I have a 30-year-old son and a 26-year-old son. And I had my first child, and, you know, I was pretty good during my pregnancy. I did quit drinking for both my pregnancies, but as soon as I was not pregnant, I picked right back up again. And my disease of alcoholism, I describe it in decades. In my 20s, I was an on-and-off drinker, but I had to have it. In my 30s, things were really, really progressing. My children were involved in sports. We always hung out with the people that drank. Everyone around me drank. They drank like I did, or they drank worse than I did. So I didn't look so bad. And you know, I saw all these patterns after I got sober, because during all this, I never thought there was anything wrong, because I was running the household. I was controlling everyone's life around me quite well. You know, I worked. I really didn't see an issue with it. But towards the mid to late 30s, things really started to pick up for me. And then in my early 40s, that's when it got really, really bad. There was not a day that went by that I didn't have anything in my body to change the way I felt. Things started happening to me. that I never thought that I did things I never thought that I would ever do. You know, I'd wake up in places I didn't know where I was. I was in places where married women shouldn't be. I was still married. I'm still married. And, you know, I just, again, I didn't think anything was wrong with any of it. I thought that I was just living my life the way I wanted to live it. And then my youngest son at the time was 17, and he came home and told me that his girlfriend was pregnant, and she was 16. That pretty much put me into a tailspin. And when she was 7 months pregnant, her mother threw her out of the house, so I took her in. I know I'd met the girl twice, and she moved into my house. They had the baby, and through all this time, they were not happy with my habits whatsoever, and they let me know about it. And I had an older son who was also at the house, but he never really had much concern for my drinking or my using because he was right there. He was right there with me. And the kids used to come to my house because I knew they'd be safe at my house. If they wanted to drink, I just wouldn't let anybody leave. So it became that type of an environment. Again, I really didn't think there was anything wrong with that. I'm not proud of that, you know, drinking with my kids, but that's what happened. And it was much, much worse at the very end. And so we just kind of went on, and my youngest son, Corey, and his wife, they moved out right before the baby turned a year old because they could not stand me anymore. They just couldn't stand me anymore. And I was resentful, angry. How dare you? I've given you a place to live, you know. My son was very responsible. He finished school, worked full time, took care of the baby, and you know, I gave them a place to live, they get back on their feet, and you know, then they moved out. And I did see them some, and but not that they would not leave me alone with the baby. And again, I just couldn't understand that. I just couldn't understand that at all, you know. And it just blew me away. And but by this time, my other son had moved out, so there were no kids in the house. I could do whatever I wanted, when I wanted, with nobody on my back. And it was great at the time. And it was getting harder and harder, though. It was getting harder and harder. I can remember the no alcohol sales on Sunday thing being a big problem. I had to plan ahead on Saturday. And I can remember one time going to Sam's, because that's where I bought my wine, because it was real cheap. And if you bought more than 4 bottles of wine at Sam's, you had to sign a paper saying you weren't going to sell it. And I was like, oh no, I'm not going to sell it. I thought that was absolutely hysterical. I said, this is, I'll be back on Wednesday, you know. And they all just kind of looked, and I thought it was absolutely hysterical, you know. It was just what I did, you know, and it wasn't for anybody else. So, you know, life went on, and my drinking went on, and it got worse, and it got worse, and it got worse. I could not go a day without it. And then after what I thought really fun weekend, where there were a lot of other substances involved, I went to work on Monday morning like I always do. Not bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, but I was there, and I could do my job. I was, you know, very good at what I did. And my boss called me into her office, and she said, Karen, we've had a complaint on our anonymous compliance line about you. I went, what? Yes, this person called in and said that you drink too much and that you do drugs. And we have to take you downstairs for a drug test. And I'm like, oh, no, there's a mistake. There's a mistake. That can't be right. She goes, no, I have to follow up on it. And my denial was so incredible. I said, oh, I know the girl in risk management. Let me talk to her. I'll straighten all this out. No, Karen, we've got to do this. Well, I knew right then. I knew I was done. I knew it. Because I knew that I was going to test positive for whatever they wanted to find in me, they'd find in me. And they did. And then I had to go through the employee assistance. If I wanted to keep my job, which I loved my job, loved it, still did not see that there was an issue with my family. Meanwhile, my children aren't talking to me. I can't see my grandson. But I didn't think anything was wrong. It was all about saving my job. So they suggested that I go to a to Ridgeview for an evaluation. You know, that was, I had to do these things if I wanted to get back to work. All right, that's fine. You know, they'll probably put me through a little outpatient thing. I'll be back to work in 2 weeks. Well, when I went there, they told me I had to stay. They did my evaluation. They said, oh, no. And I said, well, there's got to be a mistake. I mean, I'm not that bad. And they're like, you need to stay. So I had to stay, and I stayed for 4 weeks. And I came out, well, almost 5 weeks. And even during that time, I was thinking about it today, about my time at Ridgeview. And, you know, treatment taught me the disease of addiction. It taught me about the disease of alcoholism. It taught me the signs and the symptoms. I'm a black and white girl. I needed all that. Still didn't think I had it, but I went along with it. Tried to get a little bit of open-mindedness to listen to these professionals that were trying to tell me what was wrong with me. But I didn't really get it. But I did what I was told, because that's what I do. And I got out of there, and they kept me for 3 years. Once a week, I had to go. And, you know, random testing and all that. I did what I was supposed to do. In the meantime, my children, my one son still isn't talking to me. Any efforts I made were completely squashed. And then I started coming to AA meetings. And it was in AA where I learned how to get sober. You guys taught me what I needed to do. And I really started to relate to your stories. I started to relate to your feelings that you had about things going on in your life. And I was like, wow, I feel that way too. And you guys, like, look good. Most of you, anyway. You know, looked great and happy, and people were laughing. And I didn't understand that. You know, I didn't, you know, when I got out, I could not understand how I could live without a drink. And then when I went in, I didn't know how I was going to live with one or without one. I didn't, it was a very confusing time for me. I had a lot of denial. I had a lot of, I don't know about all this until I got to AA. And I got a sponsor because I couldn't get out of treatment without one. So I got one. And it was a gift from God that I began to work with her. And she was very, very gentle with me. She took me through the steps. I did them to the best of my ability. In the meantime, I'm still trying to call to get back with my son. I called one day. I'm sober 52 days. I'm fixed. Let me see my granddad. You know, they wouldn't. He told me to quit calling, quit sending gifts, because it's confusing my son because he doesn't know who you are. And that was really hard. It was really, really hard. And when I got to the ninth step to make my amends, of course, that was at the top of my list. I did a lot of praying. I was probably sober about 13 months, maybe 14 months when I got to that step. I did them really slow. And I called him up and I said, Corey, I need to talk to you. You know, can you come over? And he said, what do you mean? You can't come to my house. Fine, I'll come to your house. So I went over to his house and just made my amends, and you know, it went great. I mean, he was cautiously optimistic, but he allowed me back into his life, and he allowed me to see my grandson. And to this day, the very next day after that amends, I took my grandson to the park, and I took a picture, and I have that picture on my dresser today, and that's my ninth step amends, because the relationship now is incredible. But I got through all that, and I just began to live again, you know, and began to work this program the way, to the best of my ability. And after that ninth step amends, we were still real cautious. The relationship between my son and my husband was not repaired. So Corey would still not come to the house, but he would still see me. So it was still very, very strange. And then they had their own financial, emotional issues, you know, being a young couple with a young baby, and had their own stuff going on. And they decided that they didn't want anything to do with us again. Nothing happened. They just disappeared off the face of the earth and moved to Arizona. And I found out they were in Arizona a month after they were there. And still wouldn't have anything to do with us. And I, of course, I thought it was just me, but it was everyone that they knew. They basically just did a geographical cure and left everything. I found out later. So I, that year and a half was really hard. Birthdays, Christmases go by, and what got me through all of that sober was the trusted servants, my friends, my sponsor, and all of you guys. You know, I had one very wise woman, my grand sponsor, tell me that to be patient and just to do what you've been doing. Just keep doing what you're doing. Just show up every day, suit up, and, you know, it'll work out the way God wants it to work out. I had to have that trust. I had to have that faith. And I had it. I had it at that time. And Christmas time was coming around. This was a couple years ago, and it was a really hard time for me. And, you know, I have, my older son has two little girls here, so, you know, I would have them, and, you know, there's just always that missing piece. So I was actually on Facebook. My daughter-in-law was talking to somebody, and she put her phone number on there from Arizona and says, "We're going to be in Atlanta on Christmas Eve." And my heart just, like, exploded. I thought, what am I going to do with this? I've got to do something with this. This is something, you know. And it had been a while. And I think they had been over there over a year. So I called my other son, called my sponsor, called everybody I knew. What do I do? What do I do? What do I do? Well, my older son said, "I'll call her. I'll call her." So he did. And then they called me. And they were ready to see me. And before that, right before that, when I found out, when I was talking to some women, some very close women, and Annette told me, "Go out and buy that little boy a Christmas present and wrap it and just keep it. You may not see him, but just hold on to it, you know, and he will know someday, whenever, wherever, that you are in his life and that you do love him and care about him. Because he doesn't know. God knows what they were telling him." So I did that. I had it. Well, everything happened so fast. The day that they contacted me, I was able to see them immediately after work, and I had that Christmas present wrapped in my car. So I was able to take it over to them and saw them. And it was just an incredible reunion. I mean, they just greeted me, and I, you know, there was no going back. There was no, "Why did you do this? What happened here?" It was just, came from a place of love from the very, very start. And that continued to go on. And within 3 months, we were visiting Arizona. The next summer, my grandson was here for 2 months in my care. And, you know, that never would have happened. That never would have happened without this program. And today, you know, I have to keep diligent with all this stuff. You know, the steps are, I'm in one or two or three or four or five of them at any given time. You know, step one, when I first came in, you know, the powerlessness, the unmanageability of my disease and of alcohol. And today I can still get unmanageable, and I can still get I'm powerless still for people, places, and things. And I have to remember that on a daily basis, because I still have the need or the want or whatever you want to call it to make sure everybody's doing what they're supposed to do. And that doesn't always work out very well. So I have to remember that I'm powerless and keep that in the front of my mind, and it works out. And then most recently, I've been in step two and three. You know, turning things back over. My son now that's in Arizona, I'm getting ready to go out there to see him in a week or two again. But he's having some really, really hard times right now. Really, really hard times. This, you know, the stuff that you don't ever want to see your kids go through. God has me 2,000 miles away for a reason. I know that. But today I can be supportive of him. I can help him. He calls me. He reaches out. He trusts me. I want this for him. I want what I have for him. But I know that he has to want it as well. And, you know, of course, that's yet to be determined. That's all to him, but I can be there for him, and I can be an example for him. So I'm doing a lot of turning it over. And, you know, steps 4 and 5, when I first did steps 4 and 5, I really didn't know exactly what I was doing. I just did it to the best of my ability. And as time went on in my sobriety, things came up that I did not address, that I had to address. And I had help with a great sponsor to get me through those things. And I was the kind that when something came up, she would tell me, "We need to write this down." And I would like immediately write it down, and I'd be calling her. It's like, I got to dump this. I got to talk about this, you know, and get it done. And it's just been such a relief. And then 6 and 7, this is funny. 6 and 7, probably the third or fourth time I went through 6 and 7, I did it over a year, just those two steps. We got together with a women's group, and we did the book, Drop the Rock, which is just steps 6 and 7. And it took us over a year to get through that book. But I tell you what, the stuff that comes up from doing those steps are absolutely incredible. Those defects and what to do about them, more importantly, the solution and what to do about them. Is just incredible, just absolutely incredible. You know, 8 and 9, I've pretty much covered all my amends. There's a few that are still hanging for people that are, I don't know where they are, but I can continue to not create wreckage of my future and not continue to do anything where I have to make amends for. And then step 10, that daily inventory, I'm not as good at it as I should be. But when I don't do it, I feel it. I know it. I know when things aren't right, and I know what I need to do. And that's go into step 11. And get that prayer and meditation done, which is why I really love my home group, the Early Risers group, because we do a lot of the 11-step prayers and 3rd-step prayers, 7-step prayers as a group. It takes us about 20 minutes, and we get through all of them, and it's a great way to start the day, and it's a great way for me to get centered. And when I have to work and I miss my meetings, I try to get some of that stuff done before I go to work with some quiet time. I get up a little bit earlier to do that. And then step 12, giving this away. This, I wouldn't be here if I couldn't give it away. I mean, I have 3 sponsees that are active and a couple that are non-active that call me once in a while, but that is a true joy, is to be able to give this away to somebody else and to watch the lights come on and watch them get better and watch them stumble and watch them get back up again as well. You know, that keeps me sober too. I was having a rough time a couple weeks ago with everything going on with my son, and I hadn't heard from any of my girls. And we have a women's group that we meet on Mondays, and I told them, I said, "You guys have got to call me and tell me what's going on. I got to get out of myself," you know. And sometimes I'll pick up the phone and call them too, but you know, it's just such a joy, and it is such a gift to be able to work with another woman, to be trusted to work with another woman, you know, to be able to give this away and to have the life that I have. To be able to share that is just absolutely incredible. You know, I never thought that I'd have fun again, you know, when I wasn't drinking. And, you know, I've had a weekend full of fun I'm still tired from, you know. It's just been one thing after another of just fellowship and service and great, great friends and great family relationships. My 2 sisters are both still out there. So our relationship is not as close as it used to be because of that. They don't understand. They don't think I have a problem at all. They never thought I had a problem. So we're not quite as close as we used to be because, you know, our relationship was centered around drinking. And, you know, that common denominator has been taken away. So I do grieve that. I do grieve that sometimes, but it's not the kind of relationship that I want. And I am currently still married. I've been married for almost 32 years, and it's an interesting journey. You know, it's got its ups and it's got its downs, that's for sure. But you know, alcohol was the common denominator in our relationship as well, and that is gone. And so we have some adjusting to do, and we're still adjusting. But, you know, one day at a time, it works itself out. And I know that God has got this. I know that He's got all of this. And that's one of the biggest gifts that I've received coming into AA, was finding my God. I had a God when I got here. I was born and raised a Catholic. All Catholics have God. We're a fearful God, you know. And but I never really thought that I needed Him very much. You know, I knew He was out there, but I didn't think that I really needed Him until I got here. And my concept of God has 100% changed since I've been sober in AA. You know, my God is with me. My God is kind. My God is loving. He will do what is right for me, whether I like it or not. And all I have to do is ask and try to stay in His will. And I know when I'm not in God's will, because I don't feel right. Things don't go right. I'm exhausted. I'm tired. I'm fighting. It's like swimming uphill. And all I have to do is stop and just pause when agitated or doubtful, as we say every morning. And I'll hear the right answers. I'm not good at it all the time. I don't do it all the time, but I know I can. It's a tool that's out there. But, you know, when things get crazy and wheels are spinning, I know it's not my will, because I don't feel right. It just doesn't feel right to me. So that is a feeling or a skill or whatever you want to call it that has developed over time that I know I'm just scratching the surface of right now. And I really look forward to continuing to grow that relationship, because it is the basis for my life today. It is the basis for my life today. And I don't know where I'd be without it. But it's a good life. You know, getting my family back and getting my children back. You know, there were so many hopeless nights. I never thought that it would turn out this way. Especially after they were gone to Arizona. Especially after they left. It was like, this is it, I'll never see my child again. And, you know, losing my parents at such a young age, my family was extremely important to me, what I had left of them. And I would hold on with a death grip to them, to the point where they left. And, you know, the way it is now, it's just absolutely incredible. You know, even my daughter-in-law, you know, my son and daughter-in-law, I don't even know if I said that in the beginning, they were the ones that turned me in to work. They were the ones that called the compliance line. I forgot to tell you that. It's kind of like a big piece. Oh, wow. Yeah, they called. They're the ones that called, I found out later. And I kind of knew that they were the ones that called, because they got really, really mad at me the week before because I took their car away. That was really my car. But they didn't like that. And they called. And interestingly enough, most recent revelations I've had over that I did not know. This was 7 years ago. I always thought it was my daughter-in-law that called, because she was the feisty one. She was the one who was so against any alcohol or any drug. I mean, just, she has zero tolerance for any of it whatsoever. And that's what I was told, that my daughter-in-law had called. Well, one of the recent events of my son having been in trouble, and he's in trouble for drugs and alcohol, and I was talking to my boss about it. I've had the same boss for over 20 years, so she knows me very well, and I was on the phone at work with my son and lawyers and stuff like that, and telling her what was going on, and she's not an alcoholic. She's a totally normal person, the most normal person I know. And when I told her what was going on, her face got white, her eyes got big around, and her mouth fell open. And I'm thinking to myself, why is she so surprised that my son's in trouble for drugs and alcohol? You know, I mean, she just was shocked. Well, she said, Karen, I don't think I've ever told you this before, but your son's the one that called. I talked to him on the phone at length about how you were so bad and how you were tearing apart the family and that you really needed help. You know, he was talking to her, and I never, ever, ever knew that until about a month ago, that it was him. And now he's reaching out to me. So it's just amazing how things come around and how God has the path completely filled out for us. You know, just completely filled out. We just have to walk it, or I have to walk it. I have to walk it the best that I can walk it. And, you know, they keep telling me more will be revealed. So that's really all I have.
On that broad highway.